you may remember deep in your mind cave, we once told you about a podcast, wasn't once, it was last year, called Wisecrack, from our good old buddy old pals over at Tenderfoot. Wisecrack is a really unique blend of stand-up comedy set and a shocking true crime case. Basically, a comedian describes the night he found himself at the centre of a double murder. Wisecrack has gone on to make Apple's best podcasts list, and that's full of people like us, so you know it's true. And it's nominated for iHeart and Ambi Awards this year. And it was The Guardian's podcast of the year, top tier, number one, top spot. And now Wisecrack is heading on a true crime slash comedy tour with comedian Ed Hedges performing his stand-up set live. And it's in a city that is maybe, very possibly, near you. Wisecrack's tour will hit Dublin and Manchester, as well as London on Valentine's Day, and then it will head into the US for February and March. For dates and ticket info, visit wisecracklive.com. That's wisecracklive.com, and search Wisecrack in your podcast app to listen to the show and see what all the noise and hype is about, my friend.
Hey guys, very quick announcement before we kick off with today's show. We have some very exciting news. We are launching a brand new line of merch. It is the Get in the Bin merch, which you guys have been asking us for months to do, and we are finally delivering. So if you would like to get early access to the merch store, as well as an exclusive little discount, all you need to do is click on the link that's in the episode description, stick in your email address, and then just wait. The store is going to open for everybody next Thursday, so that's the 30th of April. If, however, you sign up now, you will get access to the store on Wednesday, the 29th of April at 9 a.m. And you'll also get that exclusive discount code. If you are a patron, don't need to do anything. Just kick back. We'll send you a link and we'll send you the code. And another important thing about this merch is that I'm sure you guys have seen that there has been an unprecedented spike in domestic abuse and domestic violence during the lockdown for COVID-19. We wanted to do something to help some of the amazing charities and organizations supporting victims during this difficult time. So we are going to be giving a percentage of all the proceeds from the sales of this merch to Solace Women's Aid. So thank you very much, and on with the show.
I'm Hannah.
I'm Saruti.
And welcome back to a normal episode. I feel like we don't do normal episodes anymore. Every time we do one, I'm like, oh, this is like putting on an old pair of shoes.
Exactly.
It's like worn through, it's got like holes in the toes, but you know it's going to get you there.
That's all we need. Welcome back to the original red-handed, everybody.
The orig. Ready salted, red-handed.
God, now I want crisps.
I want a wee, but there's always someone in the fucking bathroom, so I can't.
Oh.
So I'm going to be like one of those politicians that like speaks with like loads of urgency because I really need a wee and I haven't been able to get in the bathroom all fucking morning.
Oh, maybe you need a little contraption.
Well, a bottle. A catheter.
We've all weed in weirder things. I once weed in a pot noodle.
Did you? Did you eat it afterwards?
No, it was an empty pot noodle pot, but I was desperate. I was at a festival and I was like, it's going to have to happen.
Oh, festivals don't count.
Try to think of weird places I've weed in my house. I mean, I feel like you get free rein during this. I'm not going to say it because then I'll be in the sin bin during this period of time.
During this, the thing. Well, I'm going to have to say it in the introduction, so I'm going to have to put a quid in anyway. It was worth it for the alliteration. So send in the weirdest place you've weed in your house. My washing basket was looking pretty tempting this morning. They're already dirty clothes. What's the difference?
Absolutely not a single difference to it.
Apart from the fact you have to pick your pissy clothes up out of the basket and put them into the washing machine. That's
something.
Didn't
the Romans used to wash their clothes in urine though? Didn't they think it was like
to dye it, I think. Oh. I think the Vikings too.
Just a nice little pale yellow tinge. Depending on how dehydrated you are. It doesn't matter anymore, especially not related to anything we're going to speak about today. So fuck the Romans.
And on that incredibly pertinent and relevant note, let's get on with it. If you listen to our upcycled episode on the Silent Twins that we released on Saturday as part of our Corona Confinement Confrontation Program, I'm going to put a quid in the bot for that because it was worth it. You might remember that both June and Jennifer Gibbons, the twins from the story, had a recurring shared nightmare about being suffocated by a large man.
Jennifer was born second and was the larger baby. She was also born breech, so it's possible that she was, in effect, sitting on June in the womb. And June is the less dominant, smaller twin. So you could argue that this was the dynamic that followed June and Jennifer throughout their whole lives. Jennifer was always the leader and June was always the follower. And strangely, as outlandish as that might sound, there are a selection of people, some even call themselves therapists, who argue that the circumstances of your birth can shape the person you become and even dictate your biggest struggles with the crushing psychological pressure of being alive. And I know we're all feeling that quite heavily at the moment. Especially me. Have you seen that tweet that's like, I'm a really laid-back person. I only care about two things. One, every person on earth and their opinion of me. Two, the crushing psychological pressure of being alive. Yeah, that is me. That is who I am as a person.
Well, shall we have a Zoom red-handed rebirthing where we all just virtually get together and have a little rebirth?
You can't spoil it. We haven't said rebirthing yet.
Oh, sorry. I just read the notes.
God, can't get the star.
Move that into later.
So these people reckon that, for example, if you feel like you are controlled by everyone else around you and find it difficult to speak up, it might be because you had an induced birth and you didn't feel ready. And if you don't like confrontation, that could be a result of a difficult labour where you were held back in the womb, meaning that you're afraid to come forward for anything. People born via cesarean section might find it difficult to be tactile with other people. Apparently, even drug problems in adulthood can be connected to drugs administered during childbirth. So how do these, inverted commas, therapists suggest we combat these issues? That's quite simple. They argue that we have to completely invalidate our original experience coming into the world with a practice they call rebirthing that gives you a new birth experience and solves every single last one of your problems. Funny that, isn't it? Just like magic.
Just
give
like
them $7,000 and it's all
better
fine.
Better than magic. Magic doesn't even solve all your problems. It just makes you go, oh. I know we're obviously going to spend a lot of this episode talking about rebirthing. Surprise. But I do immediately just hate, apart from what it tells the person about their challenges that they may be facing in life, I also just hate what it says about like the way in which women choose to deliver their babies. Like, oh, well, if you have a cesarean, this kid's going to have real issues being tactile in the future. Are you taking drugs? Oh my God, your child is going to be a drug addict. Like,
yeah,
fuck off.
Totally. And it's just very like, oh, none of this is your fault. This was completely preordained for you by your silly mum.
Yeah, exactly.
I hate it. I hate everything about it.
Yeah. Spoilers, we hate it. According to rebirthing counsellor DK Begg, who guides rebirthing ceremonies in Ireland, so-called rebirthing is essentially an advanced yogic breathing technique, which has been specifically developed to reach the parts of the body that normal breathing just don't. She also claimed that, quote, memory is stored in minerals within our cells, and this rebirthing stimulates these memories.
Does it?
I feel like probs not, but maybe.
I mean, there are a lot of things about the human body that we don't understand, but I don't think this is one of them.
No, I feel like there are lots of things we don't understand, so we should continue to strive to try our best to understand and not just say, hey, I think you need a rebirthing ceremony and then you're going to be totally chill and all your problems will be gone. Beg sessions, if you are, I don't know, interested in partaking in one. They last two hours, and she claims to have cured people from conditions such as asthma and even IBS.
Yeah, who knew breathing could solve your poops? Not me.
Not me, and not medical science, because there's not even a test for IBS, let alone a cure for IBS. If you can cure IBS, you will be a billionaire like that, my friend. I don't know. I feel like I have difficulties being tactile with people and I have IBS. Maybe I need a rebirthing. Let's do that. Let's have a Zoom red-handed in unison rebirthing and let's see what happens. Maybe we can get Beg in on it.
I think they have to do it to you. I don't know if it's a remote. I think in the current situation, rebirthers are going to be having a real hard time in the economy.
Oh, poor them. As you can imagine, rebirthing has come under pretty severe fire from both the academic and the psychiatric community as being unfounded quackery that is practiced by unlicensed people calling themselves therapists. But that attitude hasn't stopped around 40 rebirthing centres cropping up all over the United States.
Rebirthing first pushed its head through the cervix of the New Age movement. I'm so pleased with myself. I had a little chuckle to myself for about 10 minutes after I wrote that. So obviously, the New Age movement, that's the 70s. And rebirthing, as we know it today, was pioneered by psychotherapist Dr. Leonard Orr. So he was a real life doctor. His treatment plan included lots of breathing and only lasted about 15 minutes. So that's pretty mild compared to what we're going to be talking about today. And we see that quite a lot, like the original, the sort of seed of an idea is always quite mild and then it just gets concentrated by everyone who practices it afterwards. And that's exactly what we're going to be looking at today. And rebirthing had a quick 15 minutes of fame as being a superstar treatment for attachment disorder, which is recognized in the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders. People, or most of the time children, suffering from attachment disorder find it difficult to establish relationships. Symptoms include failure to make eye contact, lying, stealing, poor impulse control, cruelty to animals, and a perceived lack of conscience. Attachment disorder is split up into two different categories, both of which arise in the first 5 years of life. So we've got reactive attachment disorder, which is RAD, and that's associated with emotional disturbance. So children won't be reactive to circumstance. They'll have poor social interaction, withdrawn attitude. They'll show aggression towards others, and they won't seek out comfort from others or their caregivers when they are in distress. The second subcategory is disinhibited attachment disorder. Children diagnosed with this disorder are attention-seeking and indiscriminately friendly. An attachment disorder can be caused by a few different things that all come under the umbrella of childhood trauma. Things like maltreatment, neglect, multiple care placements, separation from primary caregivers, drug and alcohol abuse by the parents. These things can all contribute to the development of an attachment disorder in a child.
And diagnoses of attachment disorder soared in the late 90s and early 2000s, as international adoption also saw a similar rise in popularity. To the untrained eye, it seems that loads of new parents were not getting on with their new babies as well as they'd hoped. Parenthood was not the dream that they had hoped for. So they slapped a disorder label on the child.
And we're not saying that attachment disorder isn't real. It definitely is real. But I think that we see this quite often, like a child is not practically perfect in every way, and then suddenly they get diagnosed with all of these things. And I think it is an important thing to point out that attachment disorder takes off when international adoption does. And I don't think we can ignore the correlation in those numbers.
So attachment disorder cannot be medicated. The only way to make progress with it is to improve the relationship between the caregiver and the child through CBT and interpersonal therapy and family therapy. The answer is certainly not wrapping that problem child in a blanket and making them fight their way out as four fully grown adults sit on them. But unfortunately, that is exactly what we're dealing with today.
The only name the child at the centre of our story today managed to keep hold of for her all too short life was Candace. Her surname and her middle name were changed by grown-ups without her consent. Candace was formally adopted when she was 7 years old, and her name was changed from Candace Tiara Elmore to Candace Elizabeth Newmaker. Candace was adopted by a middle-aged lady called Jean Newmaker, who was significantly better off than Candace's birth family. Jean lived in a 5-bed house in Warren, Pennsylvania, paid for by a trust fund set up by her grandparents. Jean's father ran a very successful furniture company, and as a kid, Jean never wanted for anything. But when she was all grown up, she didn't start a family of her own. We don't really know why. It seems like something she wanted to do, but for whatever reason couldn't, until she adopted Candace.
But it wasn't all sunshine and daisies in the Newmaker household. Jean's father had a severe drinking problem. And when he died, Jean was the only sister out of the three to even attend his funeral. As traumatic as that may have been for Jean and her sisters, I'm afraid it is absolutely nothing compared to the life Candace's family led. Candace's birth family were from Lincoln County, North Carolina. She was born on the 19th of November, 1989, to Angie Elmore, who was just 18 years old, and Candace was her second child. Angie's firstborn was given away for adoption, and so Candace was Angie's second chance. She wanted to prove to everyone in her life that she could be a good mother. She had married Todd Evan, and his lengthy criminal record at just 17 years old, to try and create the family unit that she had longed for, but never had. Angie's own mum, Mary, had grown up in the care system. She and her older sister were abandoned by their mother. Mary's earliest memory was being caught eating out of her neighbour's bin. Mary married young and had Angie and another son. But her marriage fell apart, she lost her job, and she was sleeping in her car.
Angie and her brother were taken into care. Mary couldn't think of anything worse than her children growing up on the streets. In one of the many homes that she spent her childhood in, Angie was forced to eat dog food as a punishment. Mary moved around a lot and would occasionally drop in on her children. But what Angie described as part-time motherhood put a significant strain on their relationship. Through the years, Angie had all of her children taken into care. Candace was briefly returned to her, and she begged her mother to never let them take her away again. Angie promised that she never would, and that her and Candace would be together forever. Whether Angie knew it or not, that was a lie. Candace's grandfather, David Davis, that's on my list, all along with Christmas Humphreys and Brad Bradley.
Is that a failed Tory leader as well, wasn't he? David Davis.
Oh, yeah, I forgot about that.
I think we called him the greyest man in the world. I can't remember. Somebody remembers.
Just why would you do it to your child? Anyway.
No idea.
So this particular David Davis, not failed Tory leader David Davis, knew that Candace's environment was not stable and the increasing violence from her father was a constant worry. Candace was always loved, but there was a level of neglect difficult to overlook.
In 1992, Angie left her husband and she held a third birthday party for Candace in a women's shelter. David Davis knew that this life on the road couldn't go on forever, and he also knew that parents who adopt children have to go through a rigorous vetting process. He beat himself up about this decision for years. But Candace was put up for adoption in the hopes that someone somewhere could give her a better life. Well, last night I started watching that documentary with Prue Leaf and her Cambodian adopted daughter.
Oh, no, I've never heard of it.
Really interesting. I think it was on Channel 4 on Tuesday night, but I recorded it and was watching it. And basically, I didn't know this, but Prue Leith, who, if you guys watch the Great British Bake Off, she's obviously one of the judges on there. And she adopted a Cambodian baby, a little girl, just before the Khmer Rouge started their genocide. It is so intense. And I was watching it with my mum, and fuck me, if you don't cry buckets watching it, I don't think anything will make you cry. They basically go to Cambodia to try and see if her mum is still alive, like her birth mum. Fuck.
Wow.
It's intense. And in it, actually, I think Prue is very brave because she talks about the fact that she adopted this baby in the 70s and, you know, international adoption, blah, blah, blah. And that she now is filled with so much guilt because she just thought, well, I'll just bring her here. We'll bring her up in the Cotswolds and she'll be English. And she never talked to her daughter about her Cambodian roots or her heritage. And now she's just like racked with so much guilt about it. It's really interesting. Back to today's story. Candace was put up for adoptions in the hopes that she would find herself a better life. Instead of being moved around constantly with things happening to her, like her father pawning her high chair. And so with that, on the 14th of June, 1996, Candace Tiara Elmore became Candace Elizabeth Newmaker. Her old name and her old life erased as she was adopted by Jean Newmaker. The records of Candace's adoption are tightly sealed, and this leaves quite a disjointed paper trail of her life.
Nurse practitioner Jean took 2 months off work to welcome her newly arrived child. Candace was given everything she could have possibly dreamed of. There was nothing Jean didn't do for her. Candace had ballet lessons, swimming lessons, horses, and a little pink bike. She was sent to a good school, and her first few days were a bit tricky. She told the other children not to look at her and not to talk to her. But I think that's a pretty normal defense mechanism for a child that has been bounced around several group homes. Candace also had issues with male teachers, initially refusing to enter their classrooms, exclaiming that she didn't like boys. But after this slightly rocky start, Candace settled down and made friends with pupils and teachers. Many of the teachers from Candace's school and her Sunday school teacher said that they all thought she was fine. She wasn't the ideal student, but she certainly wasn't a nightmare one.
Candace did experience teasing, however, from her classmates about being adopted. She told one of her friends, quote, "You're lucky. You're with your family. Your mama loves you. Sometimes mamas don't want their children." This feeling of being unwanted caused significant problems in the Newmaker house, according to Jean. Candace was almost unmanageable. She abused animals, was emotionally distant. She pulled down bookcases, avoided all forms of affection, and also started fires. So Jean decided to tackle this issue with a number of different strategies. She started off by consulting Dr. Ava Lachowicz, a pediatrician who described Candace as not a normal happy kid. Quote, she could smile and be real cute, then she could be mean. It was like having the average 18-year-old adolescent in your house. Candace was carted around all sorts of different doctors and therapists and was told that all sorts of things were wrong with her. Before the age of 10, Candace was on an antidepressant, an antipsychotic, and an amphetamine.
This is difficult territory. Like, obviously, as a parent, you're going to want to do anything to help your child. And if you're going to doctors and doctors are saying, this is going to help, you're going to do it. So what we're not doing is passing judgment on Jean just yet. I think at this stage, throughout the whole thing, I think she's trying to do the best she can. She's a nurse. She was a pediatric nurse. She worked with children all the time. So she would have seen similar situations. So I think it would be easy to fly off the handle at her being like, how dare you medicate your child? And what the fuck do we know? We're not doctors or parents. So it's not a judgment. It's just a statement of fact. She was on pretty heavy stuff.
It's also something that is sort of a point of discussion and discussed within the medical community. I mean, have you seen that? I don't remember which Louis Theroux documentary it is, but that one about kids who have got like... I can't remember what it is. Like, it's something, it's got like love in the title. I don't remember. But in that, when they're talking about at what age do you start to diagnose children with pretty serious conditions? What age do you start to label them with things? And at which age do you start to medicate them? As Hannah said, we are not parents and we are not doctors. I can't even imagine how difficult it must be. And of course, when you take your child to an expert, you are going to want to believe what they're saying. But it's so difficult because are you causing more harm than good? No one knows. I don't know. But it's a question worth having a discussion about for sure.
But none of these drugs worked. Jean kept reading and researching until she eventually came across attachment disorder. I think it's important to point out now, Jean adopts Candace when she's 7 years old. All of this happens in the space of about 3 years. So you could argue that Jean isn't necessarily giving enough time to like unravel all of, because like Candace has had a fucking horrible time of it. Like, I challenge anyone to go through what Candace went through and come out like quote unquote normal.
Absolutely. And I feel like at seven, she's already experienced a lot. And a lot of that stuff is deep set. I'm not going to start being like, oh, well, you know, they say your personality is formed by this point. But she's quite an older adoption, isn't she, at 7 years old? I don't know what the average age is.
Oh, yeah.
But she's obviously lived a life.
But loads of people don't want kids that are not babies. Yeah, loads of people won't adopt over the age of like 6 months.
Exactly. Because it's quote unquote not a clean slate. She's lived a life by 7 years old. You do kind of want to say, I wish she had spent a bit more time trying to, as Hannah said, unravel what happened in those 7 years rather than jumping straight into this. But again, this isn't us judging, and it's very easy to look back on this with hindsight and say that.
When Jean came across attachment disorder, it was a real light bulb moment. Suddenly, Jean could see that she wasn't on her own. After all, loads of other people out there were having the very same problem. All of the symptoms of the disorder matched Candace's behavior perfectly. Jean took herself off to an attachment disorder workshop all the way in North Carolina, which seems like an absolutely outrageous distance to go. But maybe she thought going back to Candace's like birthplace would make a difference. I don't know.
Potentially. And I also think what you just said there is so important for parents who are going through challenges with their children, is when you find a condition and it fits everything, the relief you must feel must be completely overwhelming. It's like, finally, it's here. Other people are going through it. Somebody says they can treat it. Let's go. And of course, you would move mountains probably to get to that answer.
That's what Jean is doing. She's about to get quite misguided, but that's all she's doing. She's just trying to help her daughter. After the North Carolina conference, Jean came across the Association for the Treatment and Training in the Attachment of Children. She attended their national conference. And there she met therapist Bill Gobble. Bill listened to all of Jean's concerns about her adopted daughter and asked her to fill out an inventory sheet of all of Candace's behaviours. I imagine this like the thing you get from IKEA, where you just have to like write down all of the little numbers. Like, I think it's just a list of like, do they put their fingers in animals' bumholes? And like, do they set things on fire? Do they piss in their washing basket? etc. Like, I think she's literally just given a list.
Exactly. Does she piss in pot noodle bots that are left around from 0 to 10? Strongly disagree to never, never at all. Like, I don't know. It just seems, I don't know, it's weird because obviously when you are with a patient or with somebody in front of you, there is an element for that therapist or for that physician to work their way through how a person might be presenting, how a child especially would be telling them, what they would be telling them. Are they telling you the truth? Are they revealing everything? But then to get that information secondhand from a parent and to be like, fill out this form and tell us what she's doing. It's just like, it all just is off to a weird start.
But I think it probably might have been reassuring for Jean because she sees all of these things and she's like, yes, yes, this happens so often. There is a list and I just have to tick it.
Absolutely. I can totally see from Jean's perspective why this feels like, oh my God, thank fuck. Everything on this list matches up perfectly. But from Gobble's part,
Yeah, Gobble, not sure how I feel about you, my friend. Gobble has a look at this list of behaviours and without even meeting Candice, even once, didn't even speak to her on the phone, he told Jean that her daughter had a, quote, fairly severe case of attachment disorder. Bill warned Jean not to lose hope and recommended a pioneering, quote unquote, therapist based in Colorado who was making real progress with attachment disorder kids using her unique rebirthing technique.
This woman's name was Connell Watkins. We are not going to call her a therapist. She is about as qualified as Jez Osborne is as a life coach.
I don't even think she went to British London to print off a certificate with 4 stars. I think she just started calling herself a therapist and people for some reason believed her.
No. Connell does not and has never had a license to practice any kind of therapy. But Connell Watkins was mentored by Dr. Foster Klein, who is essentially like the Jesus of rebirthing / attachment therapy in that world. So Dr. Klein reckons that if parents don't respond to babies' immediate needs, that child's brain never grows enough to trust people. These kids then develop into dangerous children who lie all the time, have no conscience, and don't give a single shit about anyone's feelings. In the gospel according to Jesus, Dr. Klein, the way to fix these problem kids is to recreate what the child missed out on as a baby. This therapy involves restricted movement and forcing the child to physically surrender to their carer. The child is laid on the lap of their parent and their arms are held down until they submit. It's called holding therapy. And it isn't pretty. But as Klein argues, neither is heart surgery.
I hate that argument so much. Be like, oh, well, neither's a leg amputation and we have to do that. Like, you've just made this up. That's literally like me, like, oh, well, I had to set my hair on fire because the Cookie Monster told me to do it. And it wasn't pretty, but, you know, neither is fucking lungs.
Good, 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 good. It's like saying, I set my hair on fire and it really fucking hurt, but so does heart surgery. Like,
exactly.
It's just such a nonsense point to make. But I don't know. I guess when you sort of dress it up in the way that they do, and I'm sure they're very convincing, it could make you believe, yeah, maybe this is all that needs to happen. We just need to readdress that issue, and then it's all going to be fixed and it's going to be fine. Have you seen the Bob's Burgers episode where Linda makes Louise go to a rebirthing class with her?
Yes, I have. I might even put it in our references for this episode.
You may remember deep in your mind cave, we once told you about a podcast, wasn't once, it was last year, called Wisecrack from our good old buddy old pals over at Tenderfoot. Wisecrack is a really unique blend of stand-up comedy set and a shocking true crime case. Basically, a comedian describes the night he found himself at the centre of a double murder. Wisecrack has gone on to make Apple's best podcasts list, and that's full of people like us, so you know it's true. And it's nominated for iHeart and Ambie Awards this year. And it was the Guardian's podcast of the year. Top tier, number one, top spot. And now Wisecrack is heading on a true crime / comedy tour with comedian Ed Hedges performing his stand-up set live. And it's in a city that is maybe, very possibly, near you. Wisecrack's tour will hit Dublin and Manchester as well as London on Valentine's Day. And then it will head into the US for February and March. For dates and ticket info, visit wisecracklive.com. That's wisecracklive.com and search Wisecrack in your podcast app. to listen to the show and see what all the noise and hype is about, my friend.
Jean knew that this school of therapy was provocative, but she became convinced that it was her only chance.
So Jean tracked down unlicensed therapist Connell Watkins in the January of 2000, and she signed a contract promising to pay a total of $7,000 for 2 weeks of intensive rebirthing therapy.
I think that just proves as well is how serious Jean is and how much she clearly cares about Candace. She's willing to pay $7,000 for a 2 week intensive course.
Yeah.
Completely misguidedly.
Totally. I mean, she's got money. Like, I don't really think money's an issue for her. But, like, what I think is more of a red flag is they've just said, oh, just 2 weeks and she'll be fixed. That's not how therapy works.
Yeah. God, imagine if therapy could fix you in 2 weeks.
Sign me up. Another red flag is that this therapy did not take place in an office or like a therapist hospital or a psychiatric ward. This therapy took place in the house that belonged to one of Watkins's assistants. And the two-week intensive began on the 10th of April. In the preceding weeks, Candace had been taken off all of her medication. When Candace and Jean arrived at the house in Evergreen, Colorado, they were greeted by Watkins and her entourage. This entourage was made up of pretend therapist Julie Ponder, Watkins's office manager, Britta St. Clair, and a guy called Jack McDaniel. Neither Britta nor Jack had any medical or therapeutic training. Jean was told that this pair were therapeutic foster parents and that Candace was to address McDaniel as Daddy Jack.
Oh, I hate it.
No shade on office managers, but you are not and you should not be part of any therapeutic practice without any training.
And Daddy Jack, what the fuck?
Yeah, it's really gross.
Oh, I hate
and
it.
This Daddy Jack character is about to get worse. McDaniel was there during the therapy session because he had been paid $700 to write a report on the following 2 weeks of therapy. His highest educational achievement was completing high school. I don't think that's the kind of person to be writing a medical paper.
And it just immediately starts to scream of, like, just experimentation. They're just, like, siphoning off kids that are presented as having problems, like that guy, Gobble, just was like, yep, I got you another one. I didn't even meet her, but her mum filled in this questionnaire. Let's have a go.
Yeah, exactly.
So over the next week, Candace was subjected to hours and hours of these holding sessions. In one of these sessions, Candace's face was grabbed and she was forced to make eye contact 90 times. Her head was violently shaken a total of 309 times. She was screamed at 68 times. Right in her face, as she was being held on Watkins's lap and Daddy Jack sat on her legs. And remember, as we're telling you all of this, Candace is 10 years old. In another session, Jean lay on top of Candace for 42 minutes and licked her face 21 times. Candace's hair was cut off and she was forced to kick her legs like scissors until she was physically exhausted.
That shit hurts, man. They make you do that in Pilates. It's
yeah,
fucking
I was
horrible.
Honestly, I did 20 minutes on the cross trainer this morning and my legs feel like jelly. Imagine being forced to kick until you're exhausted. And maybe you're thinking, how on earth do we know all of this? It's very specific. Well, we know all of this because every second of Candace's ordeal was filmed. All of these attacks made little difference. And after a week, Candace was put back on her antidepressant.
On day one of week two, Candace progressed on to the next phase of Watkins's program. And Watkins called this particular brand of bullshit compression therapy. Candace was wrapped in a blue sheet with her head exposed and told to lie on the floor. Then the four adults covered her in sofa cushions. After 3 hours, Candace was unwrapped and ordered to crawl into her mother's lap like a baby. Jean then fed Candace with her hands. This all went according to plan. Candace even made eye contact and Jean was so happy she cried. The following day, Tuesday the 18th of April, Candace was told that she was going to be reborn. She was told that she would have to act just like a baby and that it would be difficult, that she would cry and that Candace would have to fight to be born. Watkins went on to explain, if the baby doesn't decide to be born, she will die. Ponder also chimed in saying, quote, you have to push really hard with your feet. If you stay in there, you're going to die and your mummy's going to die.
Jesus.
At 9:44 a.m., Candice was wrapped in a blue flannel sheet as she lay in the fetal position. This time, her head was not left out of the wrapping. Candice was wrapped tightly in the sheet, and she was told that she was going to go through the birth canal, and that while she was in the womb, she would have plenty of air to breathe. Then Watkins propped four sofa cushions over Candice like a tent. Watkins sat at Candice's feet. Sinclair leant against the 10-year-old's knees. Daddy Jack lay on Candice's chest, and Ponder held the sheets tightly closed over Candice's head. Jean was told to wait by Candice's head where she was supposed to emerge, reborn as the perfect loving child.
Then all four adults began to push and tug Candice. Altogether, the grown-ups weighed about 673 pounds. Candice weighed just 70. 10 minutes into this pushing, Candice said, "I can't do it, I can't do it, I can't breathe, I can't breathe." Just a minute after that, Candice said, "I'm going to die." She begs for air and the adults just kept pushing. Watkins reminded Candice that she was being reborn and it was the hardest thing she was ever going to have to do and she needed to fight for it. Candice constantly asked for help and instruction. She didn't understand how to get out or what was expected of her, but the adults just kept pushing. Candice cried, "Please stop pushing. I can't breathe. Okay, I'm dying. Sorry." Watkins and Ponder both screamed at the 10-year-old, "You want to die? Okay, then die. Go ahead. Die right now." Candice asked, "You mean for real? Like you want me to die for real?" Watkins said that she did want Candice to die and added that human life is very difficult to live. Watkins told Candice that if she wasn't willing to try, then she should just die because it was easier. The adults kept pushing.
At some points in the video footage of this, it's clear that all four adults are sitting directly on top of Candice. A dejected Jean was asked to leave the room. She had been warned that kids often tried to get out of the rebirthing ceremony by pretending that they were ill or they needed to go to the bathroom because unattached children are manipulative. But how Watkins knew that this was so incredibly common is beyond me because she'd actually only conducted four rebirths prior to this one. It comes as no surprise that she was absolutely no authority on anything at all. After 20 more minutes of sitting and pushing, Candice told the room that she was throwing up and that she had to go number two. And Watkins told her to stay in there with her poop and vomit. That is a direct quote. Candice then went quiet. She was ordered to scream for her life and asked if she wanted to be reborn. And Candice said, no. Ponder and Watkins shouted at the girl that she was a quitter multiple times. And then, only silence.
The adults kept pushing, this time for another 10 minutes. Watkins insisted that little Candice was breathing just fine and was sweating, so they should just keep going. Watkins left the room to go and speak to Jean. When she returned, she speaks to her accomplices for a few minutes about holidays and dream homes. Then she said, "Let's talk to the twerp." The twerp, of course, being 10-year-old Candice. They unwrapped the makeshift womb and found Candice to be lying completely still in her own vomit. Watkins thought that she was just sleeping. But Jean, the only person on the premises with any medical training, rushed back into the room and saw that her daughter was not asleep at all. She was blue and she wasn't breathing. The frantic Jean began administering CPR and Watkins called 911. 10 minutes later, the paramedics arrived. It was clear to them that Candice had not been conscious for quite some time. There was vomit and blood on Candice's face. Her body was cold, her pupils were fixed, and she had no heartbeat. By 11:20, the paramedics had managed to reinstate a heartbeat and Candice was airlifted to a children's hospital in Denver. She never regained consciousness, though. And at 9 a.m. the next morning, Candice was pronounced brain dead. She died of a brainstem herniation and cerebral edema as a result of asphyxiation.
Jean returned from Colorado to Pennsylvania without her daughter. A funeral service was held, but the reason for Candice's death was kept strictly secret. People didn't find out what had actually happened until Watkins, Ponder, Sinclair and McDaniel were arrested and the story made the headlines. Dr. Leishowitz, the paediatrician that we heard from earlier, told the press that she had no idea Jean was taking Candice off to, quote, some wackos in Colorado. This doctor thought that Candice was no different from any other child who'd been through that kind of traumatic childhood. Dr. Leishowitz thinks that Jean didn't give Candice enough time. Quote, "She wasn't the most damaged kid. I think this kid could have made it. It took 5 months for the news of Candace's death to reach her birth family in North Carolina. Angie had always held on to the hope that Candace would make her way back to her. So the news was absolutely devastating. Angie said, quote, "It's stupid. You don't put a child under a pillow and push on her." Angie might not be winning any Mother of the Year awards, but she certainly does have a point. What Watkins was passing off as therapy was incredibly, unforgivably stupid.
I mean, we talked about this before we started recording, but it feels like the closest thing is an exorcism. That's what it feels like they've done.
Even in the same way, like when we've done exorcism episode, like the one I think about the most is Janet Moses in New Zealand, the Maori one. And within the family's paradigm, they thought they were doing the best thing. Like within their Maori belief system, they thought that was the right thing to do. And there's a lot of stuff that I read running up to that, things that, because they thought she was possessed like a makatu, which means like witchcraft. And in Maori culture, there's a lot of discussion of makatu being misdiagnosed by Western doctors as mental illness. So like it's a real crossover. And I think what's difficult for Jean here is that she felt like she tried everything and then this was this miracle cure. But you do have to wonder, as a pediatric nurse, why she didn't give it more time. Like, she must have seen situations like this. And apparently she was really good at her job, too. But I suppose when it comes to Candace, she's not a nurse, she's a mum. And maybe that is a different kettle of fish.
I think so. I think that kind of objectivity that you could have with a patient possibly goes out of the window when it's your child. And unfortunately, she put her faith in the wrong people, because unlike with the Janet Moses case, where it was within the family paradigm and within their cultural beliefs, they believed what they were doing was right. But even in there, we obviously talk about the fact that they should have seen what was happening and that it was damaging this child and ultimately killing her. Here, it just feels like experimentation from the point of view of Connell Watkins. Like, you know, the fact that she's referring to this 10-year-old child as a twerp, the fact that they're telling her to die. How could they not hear her vomiting and choking on that? There was no belief system. It was just, let's have a go and let's see what happens. And it's just completely
reckless. Yeah, I can see that from Watkins's point of view, but I think Jean really believed. But I think you're right, like Canal Watkins, like she's just seen a niche and it's like, I'm going to take this to the absolute extreme so people will only come to me for it.
Yeah, exactly. And it's just, it's horrific. And I don't know, I think from Jean's perspective, when she is being told all these things, there is all of that stuff, you know, even when we've done exorcism episodes, we've talked about the fact that for some people, there have been shown that exorcisms as a ritual can help them deal with certain issues because they believe in it so much. Candace didn't believe in this. She didn't want to do it.
Mm.
She couldn't have even grasped the ideology behind it to believe in it because it was so alien. How was this ever going to work? Of course it fucking wasn't. So the trial of Connell Watkins, Julie Ponder, Britta St. Clair, Jack McDaniel, and Jean Newmaker began almost a year later, and they were all charged with reckless child abuse resulting in death. Watkins had three additional charges, including the unlawful practice of psychotherapy, obtaining a signature by deception, and criminal impersonation. The defense made the argument that no harm was intended, that the rebirthing was meant to help Candace, that the technique had been shown to help in other cases of attachment disorder, and that it was a high altitude and a heart defect that may have contributed to Candace's death. They all pled not guilty. But Watkins accepted responsibility for Candace's death.
Two qualified psychologists and a qualified psychotherapist testified in the trial that none of the techniques shown to the courtroom via video recording had been shown to be effective in any circumstance. And they added that the treatment not only violated the professional code of ethics, but the practice also violated the Nuremberg Code of Permissible Experimentation. And that, of course, was the standard used in the trials of Nazi doctors after World War II.
It does feel like, Candace, here's a damaged child, here's a troubled child. Either we'll fix her, or she can just die because, like, I don't know, she's so broken anyway. It almost feels like they're, to Watkins, Candace felt like nothing more than just like a disposable lab rat. I can't shake that feeling.
And $7,000. Like, this is for profit.
Oh, yeah,
like
100%. Yeah, yeah.
100%. It's snake oil. They're selling a miracle cure that's done in 2 weeks. And all you have to do is fly to my house in my assistant's house in Colorado.
I don't want to be making a mess at my house, please.
Watkins told the court, quote, Candace's death is a tragedy and so is her life. I think of her story as being an American tragedy. I can't even get fucking through this, man. Okay, an American tragedy because there are thousands of children in this country today who have suffered trauma during their first 2 years of life. They will also be misdiagnosed and mistreated and ineffectively treated for years. Many of them, if they're lucky, will be adopted by loving parents, much like Jean Newmaker, and they will devote all their resources and all their energies to heal their child from the emotional and behavioral problems that they didn't create. And when and if they fail, they will be blamed.
Wow.
That is some brass neck to say that after you've just killed a 10-year-old girl.
Jesus. Fucking don't you even dare say her death was a tragedy. It's a lot right now.
Watkins was facing a possible sentence of 48 years in prison, but it wasn't to be. Judge Jane Tidball presided over the trial, and although the jury found all of the defendants guilty, she said, quote, "There was no evidence at the trial that the defendant wanted to harm Candace."
Which is the same argument from the Janet Moses case. They didn't want to harm her. Yeah. They didn't want to kill her. That's not really the point.
And that's the thing, isn't it, with homicide, is like you have to prove the intention. And if the intention isn't there, this is child abuse, so it's a bit of a different thing. But if it were an adult, I think this would have been manslaughter also.
I mean, in the US, though, they have second degree, which I feel like that's what this would be, because it would be like without the intention, but you acted in a reckless manner in which you should have known that your actions could have led to death reasonably.
But that's their manslaughter equivalent, isn't it?
Yeah, I do.
Second degree?
Very confusing. So Jean Newmaker served no time in jail at all, and she was allowed to return to her job as a nurse practitioner. She was given 400 hours of community service, and she was barred from working with children for 4 years. Watkins and Ponder both received 16-year prison sentences. St. Clair and Jack McDaniel, or Daddy Jack, were both handed 10 years of probation and 1,000 hours of community service. Watkins was released from prison in 2008 after serving 7 years of her sentence. She was sent to a halfway house at the age of 62, and she has an ankle tag and is under intense supervision and significant restrictions on how she is allowed to interact with minors.
I don't know what happened to Ponder. I don't know if she's still in. I know she had an appeal that wasn't granted. This case has had major repercussions in both North Carolina and Colorado. In 2002, Candace's law was passed, which explicitly prohibits dangerous reenactments of the birth experience. As far as we know, and we could be wrong here, so please let us know if we are, Candace is the only child to have died in the United States as the result of a rebirthing. But attachment disorder has been used in multiple defenses. In 1997, Renee Polreis was sentenced to 22 years in prison for the death of her adopted son, and she argued that he was not beaten to death with a wooden spoon, but suffered from attachment disorder which made him impossible to control and caused him to mutilate himself. Similarly, Joseph and Heather Cambron claimed that attachment disorder led to the death of their adoptive son in 1995. He was covered in more than 200 bruises when he was taken to hospital. They too said the wounds were self-inflicted. Joseph was sentenced to life imprisonment, and Heather pled insanity. I feel like you've got to pick one. Is it attachment disorder or are you insane? We have absolutely no doubt that attachment disorder is real and a lot of people are struggling with it. It exists. But it's difficult to ignore the fact that it's been hijacked by people abusing their children and so-called therapists offering a catch-all cure for their own financial gain.
Absolutely. Obviously, we talked about this in, last week's episode, Charlene Downs' episode. I used to produce, you know, child protection conferences. I used to spend a lot of time speaking to child therapists, child psychologists, and child psychiatrists. And one of the ones I respected the most, she told me that the number one concern for most schools, most parents, most people, especially in our country, is children with attachment disorders. It is absolutely real. It absolutely exists. There's no even questioning that. The fact is, what's happening here is that these parents are desperate because it's manifesting itself in a way in which they feel that this child is destructive. They feel sad. It's, of course, incredibly stressful. And these people are manipulating these incredibly vulnerable people at the worst time because they're so desperate. Like you said, for experimentation, status, and money. And it's just so sick. And I don't know how much this must be happening to kids that just end up even more traumatized and don't die. We only find out about the cases that they're dead imagine what else is going on.
And because it isn't a regulated therapy, because they're not real therapists, we genuinely have no idea. It could be going on in back gardens, in paddling pools. No, absolutely no clue at all. Totally unregulated.
It's completely terrifying.
So there you go. Two dead kids in a row. You're welcome. Yeah, that's that. That is Candace Newmaker. And you can come and look at our faces on social media. Ooh, merch. So go and sign up for your merch. Follow us on social media at Red Handed the Pod. Send us small turtle key rings in the post. We'll do whatever you want because there are no rules anymore. You can get extra super duper bonus Patreon content at patreon.com/redhanded. It is, of course, linked below in the episode description. And here are some people who have already done that. We've got Lindsay Rhodes, Sean Power, Danielle Matzke, Lake Lucy Murder Mystery Guild, pardon, Maddie Dilly, Rebecca Steele, Julie Campbell, Penny Tristram, Carlene Hotchkiss, Carrie Jensen, Vereen DeBice, Chelsea Welsh, Lydia Saad, Tessa, Leanne Akerman, Becky Loftow, Sophie Newton, Katie, Rachel Bloomfield, Eleanor Harper, Daria, Katie O'Connor, Rhiannon, Sarah Stanford, Sophie Loretta, Annie M, Rachel Alice Jones, Heather Manning, Danielle McIntosh, Julie Humphrey, Corinne Hatch, Malcolm Clough, Alexandra Ritchie.
Our tag team.
Tag.
Eden Tehane, Crystal Hope, Luana Hesa, Wayne LC, Claire L. Justina. I don't know why I struggle to say that so much. Justina Seminate, Tiffany Ross, Andrea Morong, Anna Neenan, Amanda Gunderson, Tom O'Sully, Mary Levine Hornack, Tabitha Fraser Blanks, Patricia Riels, Alexandria Speller, Corey Quinn, Tim Sherburn, Taylor, Natalie Hogue, Madison
Huff.
Mitchell, Soraya Butt, Kai Boyd, Kyle Hudson, Raunak Kandaka, Beth Green, Caitlin Alvarez, Emma Torrance, Alice Salomon, Sophie Holland, Sophie Page, Anna Gaffney, Alva, is that right? Mm-hmm. Danielle, Trevi Perret, Lucy Craswell, Lucy Tragavalia, Torrance, Christina Brennan.
Torrance.
Christina Brennan, Firda A., Dominique McDaniel and Whitney Fogg.
Thank you guys so much. I've got to go because I'm going to piss my pants. Bye.
You may remember deep in your mind cave, we once told you about a podcast. Wasn't once, it was last year, called Wisecrack from our good old buddy old pals over at Tenderfoot. Wisecrack is a really unique blend of stand-up comedy set and a shocking true crime case. Basically, a comedian describes the night he found himself at the centre of a double murder. Wisecrack has gone on to make Apple's best podcasts list, and that's full of people like us, so you know it's true. And it's nominated for iHeart and Ambie Awards this year. And it was The Guardian's podcast of the year. Top tier, number one, top spot. And now, Wisecrack is heading on a true crime slash comedy tour with comedian Ed Hedges performing his stand-up set live. And it's in a city that is maybe, very possibly, near you. Wisecrack's tour will hit Dublin and Manchester, as well as London on Valentine's Day. And then it will head into the US for February and March. For dates and ticket info, visit wisecracklive.com. That's wisecracklive.com. And search Wisecrack in your podcast app to listen to the show and see what all the noise and hype is about, my friend.